This episode of the Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico podcast is brought to you by Spectacle Eyewear. Now, if you've been watching any episodes of this podcast on our YouTube channel, you might have noticed I've been wearing some pretty cool specs lately. Well, you know where I get them? Spectacle Eyewear, 505 Tremont Street, Boston, Massachusetts. Their phone number is 617-542-9600. Head down to Spectacle. Go visit our friend Paul. You'll get yourself some cool specs. Welcome to Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your very happy host, Steve Ricardo. I'm usually happy, but I'm really happy today. Deep Valley is in the house. That's right. We have Lindsay Troy and Julie Edwards, the fantastic duo that make up Deep Valley, on the show today as they get ready to go on the last two legs of their farewell tour. The tune we started you off with is their newly recorded version of the song Baby I Can Hell from their classic 2013 album Cistrionics, which was on the UK charts and paved the way for a lot of success that they had in the UK. So hang on, check this out. We'll be right back with Deep Valley and more. Being the big vinyl lover that I am, I'm proud to tell you about Joe's Albums in their two locations. The original shop at 317 Main Street in downtown Worcester, Massachusetts, and their second location out in Western Mass at 5 Market Street, Northampton. Both of these shops are loaded with both new and used vinyl. It's hard to walk in either shop and walk out empty-handed due to their amazing collection of records and other cool goodies like t-shirts, mugs, posters, etc. If you can't find what you're looking for in the retail stores, check out their website, joesalbums.com. Thank you, Joe, for being so cool. Deep Valley came out of the box hard back in 2011, 2012. In fact, by the end of 2013, they had played Glastonbury, Bonnaroo, and the Reading Festival. That's pretty incredible for a band that was barely 2 years old. Their raucous, punkified blues rock sound really caught on in the UK, where their first two records both charted and they toured there heavily. They also had success in the States, but it was clear that the English fans and press really got them. In all, they released 3 solo records, including their 2021 album Marriage, which featured guest appearances from Peaches, KT Tunstall, Jenny V from Eagles of Death Metal, Jamie Hintz from The Kills, and Jamie Lee Lindberg from Warpaint. And of course, in 2019, they were part of the Deep Lips album in collaboration with the Flaming Lips, which includes that trippy cover of Steppenwolf's The Pusher, one of my favorite songs ever. So as we find out in our talk, both women became mothers and the strain of how to keep the rock and roll pace took its toll, as well as other factors. And in September, they announced that they're doing a farewell tour, but not without a parting gift, a nice parting gift, in fact. They re-recorded their debut album, and they explain why in our talk. It sounds really good. Deep Valley, in my opinion, is one of the coolest bands and also one of the best live bands to emerge in the last 20 years. They were truly keeping the rock and roll alive. It's sad to see them go, but they have definitely left their mark. Needless to say, I was really excited to talk with them. You can tell. And I think they enjoy themselves as well. So here I am with Lindsay Troy and Julie Edwards of the great Los Angeles band Deep Valley. Welcome to those of you watching on YouTube. This is Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. If you want to hear this entire show with intros, outros, and music, please go to Spotify, Apple, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, etc. Please welcome to the show Lindsay Troy and Julie Edwards of Deep Valley. Hello.
Hey, how's it going? Hey.
It's great to talk to you. I didn't expect to be talking to you right before your farewell tour, which I just found that out in September. But before we talk about that, can we go back to the pre-Deep Valley days? I wanted to talk to you guys about when you grew up and stuff. I don't care who goes first, but I'm wondering when you started listening to music and when you realized it was something that you liked and you wanted to get involved in.
Sure. Yeah, I'll let Julie go first.
Oh boy.
We'll do seniority. First.
Okay. Yeah, I'm older, so I'm going to go first. When did I start listening to music? I always loved classical music and musical theater. So that was how I got obsessed with music, was through those genres. I just was like obsessed with Mozart's Requiem for so long as a little girl, and like Les Miserables. So those two pieces of music are probably inside of everything I've created since then, somehow or other.
Did you play any other instruments besides drums back then, or did you start on another
instrument?
No, I
didn't start playing drums till I was 25. Like, I didn't even, yeah, wow. I played piano. And then in as a teenager, I kind of got into a little like strummy acoustic guitar. My brother, I have an older brother with amazing taste, who's also an incredible artist. He's in the bands Failure and Autolux. And,
So
when I was like 10 or 11, he gave me Dark Side of the Moon. He gave me My Bloody Valentine, Loveless.
That's diverse.
And now I'm not going to remember. There was like a third one. But anyway, those two, I knew that I was supposed to listen to them and get into them. Dark Side of the Moon scared me. Like, as an 11-year-old, I was like, this is a scary record. I'm scared of this. And I didn't want to I didn't listen to it again until I was like a teenager. And then, of course, you know, I got it. And yeah, Loveless was like too loud and strange. I just didn't. But that was the first little like, okay, he was inputting that, you know, here you go. And then like eventually those were part of like my top 10, you know, records of all time.
Nice.
Yeah, I always like dated guys in bands, and I was like a photographer, and I'd shoot their shows and their band photos and like, you know, be in a big support position. And then it burnt out really heavily on that. And got really mad and decided I needed to be the band instead of, you know, be the Band-Aid. And I started a band called The Pity Party with my GBF, which stands for gay best friend, Mark Smullen. And it was like a weird experimental, like confrontational kind of non-listenable punk, art punk thing.
You guys went to England, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to bring that up. Lindsay, did you get an early start on music, or were you listening to music?
I did. I did. I'll give you the rundown, and then I have to run and make a bottle because I hear my baby crying. I'm sorry.
Quick rundown. Okay. Talking points. Go.
I was hoping he would just nap, but I hear him crying. So, okay. Well, let's see here.
You should let him cry.
Well, the thing is, I didn't give him his bottle before his nap, which he was supposed to have. He just passed out. He was so tired. And now I think he just woke up hungry. So it was kind of a weird thing.
This is great.
What mom rockers talk about, man.
basic parenting trips on my podcast. I love it.
I know. But anyways, I'm just going to let him cry for a minute.
Tips, not trips, tips. Although it's probably
he'll survive. He'll survive a couple minutes crying. Cry it out. Okay, so yes, my life with music. So I grew up, let's just put it this way. My dad was like a huge Deadhead, like big. So that's like a big part of his identity. Like he went to Woodstock and when he was a teenager and, really shaped him. Big Deadhead, you know, really liked being in the scene, you know, being a hip, cool guy in the scene. So I grew up with a lot of that around. Like I did go to some Grateful Dead concerts when I was really little, but I don't remember and then Jerry Garcia died. My dad wrote some books about Jerry Garcia, but we kept going to like, my dad was still like living the dream, like after Jerry died, like we would still go to all the spin-off-y, like, you know, bands, like all the Grateful Dead spin-off bands. Like, so I grew up going to a lot of festivals, like tons of music festivals. Wow. With my friends in a van. We would road trip like every summer, but probably more like once or twice a year, we would be road tripping, going on these really fun adventures, going to festivals. We would have like these musicians and bands stay at our house when I was growing up. So I was around that. Like the one woman I remember staying with us who was like a blues singer, I thought she was really cool. So, but yeah, just around a lot of music. I was not like, I was just grew up around the Grateful Dead, but like, I wasn't really a deadhead. I am maybe more now, like I can appreciate it more, but to me it was just more kind of the soundtrack of my youth. But the stuff that really spoke to me that I heard, like from my parents' CD collection, was like the Beatles, like stuff like that, you know, like that was one of the early CDs I remember just like loving, like pulling Abbey Road CD from my parents' CD collection and listening to that a lot. Also like a Marvin Gaye best of record that I had, from there, maybe that was from their collection. The Doors, you know, like, so that kind of stuff was that bit stuff that was a bit more like, yeah, less jammy, I guess. So yeah, like The Doors, The Beatles. And then I started piano lessons from a really young age, like 4. We have this really cool, I still have it, this beautiful upright piano from like the 1800s and in my home. And then, so I was always doing recitals, and from a young age, it was cool. It was fun doing the piano recitals, but I wanted to, for whatever reason, I had this idea. Like I asked the teacher if I could do singing and playing at the recital. So she was like, sure. So I would do like the Disney songs, you know, and sing and play them. And
you guys then, both grew up in LA, right? I meant to ask that too. You both grew up in LA?
I'm actually from San Diego, but I'm like,
San Diego.
I'm a more or less a Valley girl, you know, but a San Diego Valley girl, I guess. But the first CD I wrote, like, or album I remember really like speaking to me as like a sort of modern thing that I heard on the radio. I remember being in the car with my mom driving, and the radio was on, and I remember Alanis Morissette coming on when I was a little girl, and like what was it, You Ought to Know, you
yeah,
know,
that's okay. The one,
and I was just like, what is this? Like, I was hook, line, and sinker. I was like, this is it, baby. Like, you know, that was the first time I remember discovering like my own music on my own that I like loved. Me and all my best girlfriends, when we were little, we all had that cassette tape. We were all obsessed with it. We knew every lyric on the record to Jagged Little Pill. We had like a cover band called the Alanis Morissettes. And we were just like strum along on like the guitars and basses in my family. And then like my one friend Megan was like, had to play on like Tupperware. And apparently she told me this later that I was like being really rude to her, cause I was like, you know, you really have to buy a real drum set. But I don't remember saying that when we were little.
When did you move to LA?
I moved to LA, when I was 18.
18.
So yeah, later on, when I was like around 10 or 11 or 12, I picked up guitar. I was a folky singer-songwriter. Sorry, I just realized this is long-winded. It's just a lot to cover, many years. But folky singer-songwriter, was in a band with my sister when we were teenagers. Had a lot of record deals throughout my life. Got a really young start.
The Troys, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard about the Troys.
Kind of a weird experience because we were so young and they were really trying to like, just like they were trying to make us into like Avril Lavigne clones. It was just kind of a weird thing, you know, but when you're young, it's always a bit weird. And then anyways, in the end, that didn't really pan out, kind of maybe probably for the better. And then, yeah, I was just kind of moved to LA doing my thing, had a job, was playing shows as a singer-songwriter, and then was kind of bored with it. I didn't really love being a solo singer-songwriter. I found it, yeah, a bit boring. And then I met Julie, and the rest is history.
And I don't have to ask any questions because you're answering all my questions.
I know. Yeah, it was a lot.
Julie, did you grow up right in LA, like the Valley, or?
Yeah, I grew up in the Valley. I grew up in the Shallow Valley, Encino, Sherman Oaks.
Oh, I used to work at right on Ventura Boulevard at Metal Blade Records in like the early 90s. And I lived in Encino.
We were neighbors. Then.
I remember the street, Rubio.
Yeah. Ventura Boulevard is so different now.
I was just there last year. It's like amazing, so though. I forgot how long it was and how many stores there are on it. It's like non, yeah. You could draw. I drove all the way down to Topanga one day when I was there because I loved doing that. So
Well,
you
pleasure
guys,
drives. I love those.
yeah.
Don't do those anymore, but
You know, I haven't lived in LA since 2007, but every time I go there, I have to go down to Topanga Canyon. I have
yeah.
to.
Oh, it's
we
so
actually when we were on a when we were on a major label, we basically forced them to pay to rent us a house in Topanga because they wanted us to write more hits.
Island, right?
Like,
Island?
yeah, Island,
Yeah.
UK. And so we were like, okay, but then the only way that we can do that is if you rent us a house in Topanga. So we got this like beautiful A-frame with a hot tub, like in the trees in Topanga for, I don't know, Linz, how long were we there?
Was it, I don't know either. Was it a couple weeks or was it a month?
I don't know. It felt like a lifetime. It probably wasn't that long. We're probably still recouping that right now.
I know, right?
Probably.
Because we're like, we're old school, you know? I just,
Sorry,
in my mind, I'm just like, oh yeah,
that's
you
my
have to
chair.
rent us a house, you know? Like,
Why
we're the Red Hot Chili Peppers. You have to rent us.
not, you
We
know?
wanted to live like, we wanted to live the 90s major label dream, you know? And that seemed like that's part of
The
that
nightmare
dream.
dream.
The nightmare
It's
dream.
funny because I worked at a major label in the 90s. I was at A&M Records during the whole 90s. And
Yeah.
I don't know what kind of a dream it was, but it turned into a bad one.
Yeah. That's what happens.
So
Yeah.
you mentioned the Pity Party, Julie. And
Yes.
I know that was your first band. Now you had just left that band had just split when you start when you were running a knitting shop or something.
Yeah, I had a knitting shop called The Little Knittery. I had been working as a manager at another knitting shop, and I have no idea why I have an entrepreneurial spirit. It's really a curse.
Girl boss.
I'm really trying to suppress it all the time because it's like makes my life a profound misery. But
You still knitting? Is
I
that
haven't knit in so long. But yeah, I had a knitting shop all during Pity Party, and I kept like not being able to afford rent, and I kept having to move it and find like cheaper retail rent. So I think I was in my third location when Lindsay wandered in with her stained t-shirt, no bra, and messy hair, which is how we met. Like literally, everyone always thinks like, did you make that story up? And it's like, no, that's just literally what
I
happened is
think
I
everyone knows that story that knows the band.
but it's
Seriously.
true.
Like
Yeah,
crow they always say crochet. They met at crochet class or something.
I think was
but
crochet
it
the
well it
first
actually
lesson.
was a crochet class.
Yeah, that's true. But then she came and took a knitting class, and I had taught like hundreds of people how to knit and crochet, so I'd experienced a variety of sort of eye-hand coordination skills in different people. And like Lindsay was a really fast learner.
You always say that, and I just feel like
But
you're
you
blowing
were,
smoke up my
dude.
ass.
No, you were. I mean, there was a full range. There are people who won't learn because they're too scared. There's so much anxiety that it gets in the way of their body like absorbing information.
Well, it's probably because I'd been a guitar player and stuff my whole life, because it's like
Yeah.
the dexterity.
Did you know that she was a musician when she wandered into your store?
No, when she wandered in, I was just like, here comes a really high maintenance customer.
Yeah, so being if Julie, like tell him basically like owning a knitting store is like being a really like low earning therapist.
Yeah, it's like being a captive slave therapist, basically, because you're just there and then people can just come in and like use up your time, and then you teach them how to knit. And people would just tell me, I mean, I would get all of like, they would tell me things they'd never told anybody, which is good because I don't have any memory and I don't care. So whatever they told me, like it literally as they were saying it, it was falling out of my brain already. So it was
Knitting
fine. I was a good
psychiatry.
repository for that kind of
Oh no, I hope they're not watching this now. They're like, sorry. That was one of their core memories, you know.
Well, you know. Wow.
But so yeah, how, like, what if people, like, people would tell you what about just like their affairs or their divorces or their mental illness or just
their affairs, their childhood molestation, their whatever. I mean, they would tell me everything.
Wow.
People always tell me everything. I have a weird, I don't know what it is, but I will, but people,
you know what it is? It's because you actually listen.
But I don't listen. It's just a face I make that looks like I'm listening. Just really thinking about something else.
No, but you know what struck me about Julie when we met? Because I, you know, I'm not originally from LA. I moved to LA from San Diego. So it was a culture shock. It was a real culture shock for me moving to LA. Because in San Diego, I was kind of big fish, small pond down there. And then I moved to LA and I just felt, you know, just a lot of things, but so different, very different. But, you know, a lot of real, I don't know, a lot of real, yeah. Everyone's trying to be someone up here. A lot of narcissism, a lot of vapidness, you know, a lot of people talking at you, telling you how great they are and important and how, you know, whatever. Anyways, Julie struck me as different, and maybe that's actually because she's native LA, so she didn't have like the personality of these like narcissist imports or whatever that like came to LA to be a movie star. So she was I maybe you weren't listening, but I felt like you were actually listening, and you would reply with really interesting, intellectual, introspective answers. You were just different. You were a lot more, you were just different than the other people I'd met in LA.
When did you guys realize you were both musicians?
During that therapy session.
Yeah. In the first lesson, in the first, it was like the first crochet class was only two people. It was Lindsay and it was a filmmaker named Saskia Jewell. And
sounds famous.
Yeah. Saskia. She's right.
Yeah. That's a great name.
So like, we were just talking, you know, it was just like a total rap session because once you get the basics of crocheting under your belt, then you're just sitting and kind of doing it. So then, you know, the stitching bitch, as it's called, can occur. And yeah, so we were talking about being artists and the experience, and Lindsay and I were both sort of at, I think you would call it like a low ebb of this experience of being musicians. Pity Party was really like, we'd really lost the plot. And it
you
had
were close to going back to school, right? And kind of just, weren't you?
For psychology. Yeah.
Of course.
Well, now if I go back,
meeting it's more psychology specific, class.
And it'll be forensic psychology. That's what I would go back for now.
But
that conversation, we really bonded, you know. We really bonded during that conversation. And
well, I love Lindsay's story because I'm really so interested in childhood adversity, adverse childhood experiences. And I felt like Lindsay's story of being a musician and a pop star had happened pretty early.
Failed pop star.
Yeah, it had happened pretty early in her life. And to me, it like fell into that category. That's like one of my favorite sort of points of obsession, which is like shit that happens to us when we're young that, you know.
Yeah, it really shaped me. And it really like, I mean, I feel it really damaged me in a lot of ways. But, you know, that's okay. We all have stuff that damages us, I guess.
That's okay. We're fine.
How did you decide that you wanted to play together? Did she play some songs for you?
She gave me her solo like EP. Was it an EP, Lindsay, or an
Yeah, it was an EP. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember like closing the shop up and she didn't give it to me that first day. If we're really going into like specific detail, I feel like she kept wandering in and like,
yeah,
visiting and whatever. So finally she gave me the CD and I remember
was I a nanny at the time? I think I was a nanny at the time, right? Or was maybe I was, this was post nanny. Actually, I think I was just a background performer at this time.
Yeah.
So I was just doing background on TV and film.
Oh, you were?
So it was, that was my job. So it was very sporadic. So like I didn't
extra
have
work, you mean? Extra work?
Yeah, yeah. A background artiste. Just kidding.
Yes,
yeah,
I have a background artiste.
I remember clothing. If you comb through the remake of 90210, you'll see me a lot in the background at the high school walking.
Lindsay, you gotta like make a sizzle reel of all your background. And we can do it. It could be a music video. Come on.
I know. Yeah, it's
true. When they did the new 90210 recently, yeah. I had Christine Elise McCarthy on my show. I don't know if you ever met her. She played the psychiatrist. We're going to be about psychiatry the entire time, I think.
I was always in the high school. Was she a high school student or no?
No. She was like, she met with the old cast in a scene.
Oh,
she was Emily Valentine in the original 90210. She was on my show recently. She grew up a punk rock girl in Boston.
Yeah, dude.
She hung out with all these hardcore bands, SSD Control and DYS and all them. And I've had them on my show because there's been a real resurgence with hardcore. So I asked her to come on. She was really cool. I didn't expect to be talking about this right now.
Wow.
Yeah, Emily Valentine. Was she redhead?
She I don't know what she was in the show. I wasn't really I didn't
I
watch.
I feel like I'm picturing it. I need to look it up.
But, yeah, it's interesting.
Yes.
The film world is very much like a caste system, and you're really the lowest of the low as a background extra performer. So it's you really find out like which actors are like actually like good, authentic people. Like the ones that will like say hello and like to actually talk to the extras and the background artists, you're like, oh, you're like a good person, you know?
You know, I found that out also. I was a bass player actually in a film once. So all I did was I was in the background playing bass. But Sissy Spacek and William Peterson were the stars. They were really cool. I got to work on a few films because I did like I was assistant to a music supervisor for a while. Mm-hmm. So I ended up in a movie. It was crazy.
But you were like a featured extra.
I made a lot of money.
That's a step above the lowest of the low.
They Taft Hartleyed me. I don't know if you know what that means. Okay. So I ended up getting SAG rate.
So you had lines?
No, but I got paid $450 day, man.
Taft Hartley is so that you don't have to join the union because you don't have to join SAG the first two or three times, whatever it is. And then after that, they force you to join.
It was an enormous amount of money nothing. And I didn't even play bass very well, you know? So I was just kind of like acting all weird and shit. But I've got way off track. Sure, that's what happens. So when did
I know it's your, I'm thinking about Julie's idea of the music video.
It'd be so funny. Or at least a little bit of content for the social medias.
I know. I always like, I make my, once in a while, I'll make my fiance like suffer through, that's not the right word. I'll force him to watch something because I want to like see.
You want to find yourself?
Yeah, but actually the two movies I'm talking about are actually fantastic films. So I never make him watch like the bad shows I was on. The two movies I made him watch, we watched recently that I saw myself in was Greenberg, fantastic movie. It was a Noah Baumbach movie. That was the movie that him and Greta Gerwig, I think, fell in love.
Oh, yeah. With.
You know, that power couple, they made Barbie and stuff.
Yeah,
you know that power couple.
So that was, and I met Ben Stiller and he was so cool and nice. So that was that one. And then the Tarantino, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Love that. I've watched it like 5 times already. I absolutely love that film.
Got to spot Lindsay. She's in there.
You got it.
You one of the Manson girls?
No, that would have been cool. I'm one of the, I was one of the, flight attendants in the airport.
Wow. I got to go back and watch it and look for you. I didn't know that you were an actress.
Tarantino was calling. So me and this girl, the wardrobe was so good on that movie. I love it. Like, this is not about our band at all, but the wardrobe, because it was all authentic. Like the whole wardrobe for that movie was all authentic vintage stuff from like the 60s or 70s.
Yeah. Late 60s. Cool. Yeah.
So they had us, the flight attendants, in like real, like retro, super cute. They were like hot, I think they were hot pink or hot orange. this really cute vintage flight attendant stewardess outfits, and everything had to be vintage, even the bra. Like, they had to be like the old school bra, like everything, so that it looked, you know, they didn't want like a modern underwire. Like, it had to be truly authentic. And Tarantino was calling us the lollipop ladies or the lollipop girls. And I got Chinese food at like 5 a.m. and at LAX next to Leonardo DiCaprio. And I was like using my peripheral vision to like, you know, check him out, see how much chow mein he was putting on his plate.
I'm going to look for your scene, but I can't fast forward to
honestly,
it.
Honestly, it's so hard. Like, I couldn't even find it this time, but John was able to find it. Anyways, it's funny. That's a funny idea, Julie. You can tell she went to film school because she thinks up these types of ideas.
Film school. Where did you go to film school?
I went to NYU.
Wow. Oh, I spent
time. You know, I'm so old. So it's really funny to think about. Like, literally, we were chopping film strips and chopping like half
not
inch
old. Don't say
mag,
stuff
like
that.
Soundtrack.
She's not old.
With tape. No, we were cutting it with scissors and putting it together with tape when we edited
that's
it.
That's how they
that's
did
like
it.
How old
real
I am.
Real film, baby. The real stuff.
That's right. Real film. It's like knitting when you do it that way, because it's just all like strips and strands you're putting together.
Yeah. Is it okay if I ask a couple questions about the band?
Not at
the band,
yeah, of course.
when did you start playing together, and did you have songs that you brought in, Lindsay, or did you guys write together? How did that all start?
Okay, well, this brings me back to getting Lindsay's CD. She gave it to me, and I closed up the shop, and I got in my car, and I put the CD in, and I drove away from the shop, and all of that's very like vivid for me.
Core memory. Core Deep Valley memory.
Core memory. And I just, you know, although the music style wasn't like necessarily exactly my wheelhouse, because I've discovered later in life that I think I'm a little bit on the autism spectrum. And I'm what that translates to is that I'm a snob about music, but really I have like intolerance for certain stuff, and I'm only comfortable with certain stuff. And
The style probably wasn't like, because it was very like classic singer songwriter, and it probably wasn't like proggy enough for you or something. Enough for you.
Yeah, like whatever my weird, you know, problems are, my sensory overload problems or whatever. But basically, I just remember listening to it and just being like really like blown away by Lindsay's voice, by her choices, by like the muscularity of her voice, like the things it could do, and by the lyrics. So like there were so many things that I was like, damn, dude, like why is someone floating around aimlessly who has this capacity? Like, how can this be? I couldn't believe it. And so then we made a plan to jam. So I had been in Pity Party, but somewhere in my mind, I always felt like I really wanted to try doing an all-female thing that felt like something that was worth trying. And so we set up a time to jam, and I had a really like dear friend of mine, Ashley Reeve, who was then called Ashley Zarigian, and she is this smoking hot bass player. And I had known her from my friend's band, Great Northern, and she and I had been buddies for years. And so I was like, oh, well, Lindsay plays guitar. I should have Ashley come. And like, we have 3 different hair colors. So like, this will be perfect, man.
That was all very conceptual, like, because so Julie was very bright red at the time. I was blonde and Ashley was a brunette. So like, we got all the bases covered.
All the hair bases, you know, you need hair variety, man.
Yeah, I've got the hair variety covered. We got, you know, we got the rhythm section. We got the, you know, the classic 3-piece.
Yeah, so we got together and jammed. And I feel like were we jamming on, was it Baby I Call Hell?
No, it was it was that kind of stalkery song that was like, it was God's Country. Remember, it was, do you want me? Do you like me? Do you? Something like that.
So you
Do
had
we have
these songs.
Of that? Do we have iPhone recordings of that, Lindsay? I'm going to make a note in my to-do
maybe
list.
Maybe on that old iPhone that I dropped in the toilet that Mira plays with.
Oh, man.
You had these songs already, Lindsay, that you said, let's jam on these songs?
I think that, yeah, I was really nervous. I was really nervous, but really excited. Like, I really, like, I knew in my heart, I'm like, this is it. Because I was at that point where I was, like, ready. Honestly, spiritually, it sounds a little weird, but I think, like, the knitting, like, is what made this happen, is because I had felt, yeah, like I'd kind of plateaued in my life a little bit. Like, as you become an adult, you're not in school, you're not like challenging, learning new things. I felt like I wanted to push myself out of my comfort zone and do something to like prove to myself that I could like still pick up a new skill as like as an adult, like something totally out there, and just like do it. And that, so I did that with the crochet and the knitting. And just doing that, I feel like for whatever reason, whatever you want to call it, the universe or whatever was meant to be, destiny, it was like, I needed that step to make this band happen or something. They give me like the courage and the self-confidence or something to do this band. So yeah, I was very nervous. And so, because especially we were going into like going to be an electric rock band or whatever. And I was coming out of the singer-songwriter world. So I took a couple guitar lessons with a friend to kind of prep for our band rehearsals. And then I got some ideas, like wrote a couple ideas, just some like riffs, a couple ideas at home. So I didn't come in completely empty. And then I think we jammed on those. So they weren't like full fleshed out. Just a couple things to come in, you know, Jack White style, like, you know, you come in with an idea, but you make it seem like I'm just joking. You make it seem like you came up with it on the spot.
It's kind of like,
Let's not make jokes about Jack White in the press.
Yeah.
It's it's kind of a punk. I call it like a punkified blues.
No, but I will say, I was and am a huge Jack White fan. So I was, which is obvious by our sound. So cause he's like the, you know, I grew up loving classic rock. So he, you know, he's kind of like the modern version of like that coolness, you know? So
I call the sound, this is just what I call it, like punkified blues. Did you come up with that sound? Like the way you play, it's just so dirty sounding. Did you have that right from the start? Because you said you were playing like you were a singer-songwriter. How did you come up with that sound?
Oh, sorry. I heard my baby crying. I have to address that in a second. How did I come up with the Deep Valley sound?
Yeah, your guitar sound is really distinct. You know, it's very punkified, bluesy sounding.
Well, I just had a very limited, very limited pedals at the beginning. Like, you know, so Julie bought, like, I had a couple pedals that I went to Guitar Center and bought. That I could afford or whatever. And then like Julie bought me a pedal for my birthday or Christmas or something. So I had like a Boss octave pedal. I don't even know if I had, yeah, Boss. At first I had the Big Muff pedal. That may have been the only pedal. Then I had the Boss octave pedal. And then Julie got me a delay pedal, like a really weird, like an off brand.
Delta Labs.
But
it might be because, so I had, Pity Party was a two-piece. So I had, my bandmate and I had spent years grappling with how you fill out the sound there.
I'm sorry, I'll be right back, okay?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So I, you know, I'm sure Lindsay and Mark put their heads together because Mark had figured out some hacks for a two-piece. So like, definitely like the octave, right? You need the octaver. And, then splitting the signal, because it's like eventually Lindsay was she splits her signal between a basement and like a twin reverb or a deluxe reverb so that she gets this like larger frequency range from one instrument. And that's what Mark did. So we kind of, it's like this perfect, you know, evolution of myself coming from this two-piece and having access to the resources and information regarding doing that, and then like Lindsay's really like really well-honed classic approach to songwriting and structure and melody and Yeah, so the first jam, which we did with Ashley, it was super fun. And we decided our band was called God's Country, spelled C-U-N-T-R-Y. That would have gone over really well. Yeah. So yeah, I'd say punk blues is definitely like the attitude.
So what happened to the brunette? She didn't.
She got a job touring with Adam Lambert or something. She just basically got hired and just went on tour and has been on tour since then. Like she lives in Vegas now. So we're going to see her in March when we go through Vegas, which we're really excited about.
Nice. Did you play any gigs like early on? Like, did you start playing right away? Or did you record first? Because it seems like a lot happened from 2011 to 12.
A lot happened really fast.
Yeah.
A lot happened really fast. Probably our first gig was like Silver Lake Lounge. And maybe our second gig was like Hotel Cafe, maybe. There's a really early video on YouTube that's from Hotel Cafe.
Really?
And that was the video that sort of started to attract industry to us. And then we were being sort of poached, or not poached, but courted by an A&R at Universal Republic, talking to her a lot. And she connected us with a manager, you know, because obviously A&R, they're like, you know, I'm not going to deal with a band who doesn't have a manager. So they want to people you with a team. And the manager was Deb Fenstermacher, who I happen to have known already for many years. So that was like amazing, because it was like, you know, I think the opportunities we had early as a band, everything moved fast and got really big. And that's a perfect storm. Like the way elements need to align, even for that kind of a beginning, it's almost like statistically impossible. You know, the way they need to continue to align to sustain and grow and like,
that's the hard part.
Yeah. So all of that's a crazy perfect storm as well. You know, I think like as a band, in all honesty, I just don't think that continued to happen for us. But in the beginning, that was happening. So
you had those two singles, Gonna Make My Own Money and End of the World. And then all of a sudden, you're in the UK. You got a UK deal. Did your manager help you with that, or how did that all come together?
So basically we were working with Deb, and Deb was working with this manager, James Sandham. And James just kind of came in and like swept us away and was like, I have a plan. So he really wanted to bring us over there. He was UK, he's UK based. And
Knew that you guys would hit it out there if you went.
Yeah, that's what he wanted to do. So I remember we went over there. We played this tiny showcase at this like 80 capacity venue in Brighton. I think maybe The Haunt, but I could be wrong. And basically he said he'd never seen so many labels at one show. Like it was 80 people from labels.
So how did that buzz happen so quickly out there?
People just wanted it and knew other people wanted it, right? So, because I'm always analyzing this kind of stuff, right? So like, if one person knows someone else wants it, then the value of it increases. If those people know that a couple people want it, then the value of it increases, right? So I think like somehow word had gotten around the labels, and UK's little, it's a little manageable size world, right? So like all these labels were at that thing. And then Lindsay and I did the Dog and Pony show at so many labels in London, so many like big, from majors to tiny boutiques. We like went and met everybody. And another little aspect of this, of course, is Communion, which is Ben Lovett from Mumford & Sons label.
Yeah.
So we had gotten on his radar, and he and Communion actually signed us with Island UK.
Mm-hmm.
So Ben was and has been and is like a huge champion of ours, which is amazing.
So in between, from when you started to like by the end of 2013, you'd already played Glastonbury and Bonnaroo and
it was
the
fast.
Wedding
I mean, it was
Festival.
Just like fast.
I remember hearing about you guys, and next thing you know, you're at Glastonbury. I'm like, how did that happen so fast?
Yeah, it happened so fast.
Like the album was barely out the day, you know, Sistronic was barely out. You had the EPs and the singles, but then the album came out and whew.
Yeah. It's funny because when Lindsay and I started, I was so disillusioned at that point and like heartbroken by kind of the way things went with the pity party. And I said to myself, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to give this 6 months.
Wow.
Like I'm never like
breaking it worked.
My heart over a music thing again. And then, yeah. So ironically, I was like, I'll give this 6 months. And then literally like everything happened. It happened within that weird, arbitrarily imposed time
frame. Label trajectory.
Yeah.
So tell me about
stars, baby.
I'm really curious about what it was like for you guys to play Glastonbury. I have to ask you this because I remember watching it and I was like, holy shit. I mean, you guys were around for only a few years and here you are, the biggest festival, like I think in the world, one of the biggest. What was that like?
It was incredible. I mean, it's a dream, you know? But the truth is, like, we were so lucky. Like, we were playing, we were just touring nonstop. I mean, I don't know if that's the lucky part, but the lucky part is that we were getting to play so many incredible festivals all over the world.
But I think the reality of the experience is, you know, Glastonbury was a difficult load in because our stage was like in the middle of the festival where there wasn't like, there wasn't vehicle access. And then the festival's so huge and giant. So, and we didn't have a lot of time. So we were touring so much and we were doing so much press. So in other words, we'd hit the ground somewhere and we would do hours and hours of press around our play. So I think like, it's hard to isolate. And when someone says, what was it like to play that or do that? It's hard to isolate it because of the sheer volume of work that we were doing, basically like 24 hours a day at that time.
Yeah. I mean, that's the, like the downside is that, we got to, yeah. I mean, the upside is we got to live the dream, you know, have like the coolest job ever, like, you know, play all these beautiful places around the world to different crowds at all these amazing festivals. The downside is there's not a lot of downtime to like enjoy those places. So that's the sucky part, you know, like I always think about, whenever I talk, like I always think about being in Byron Bay. You know, because getting to Australia, it's so expensive, it's so time consuming, and we got to play out there an amazing festival, beautiful festival, get put up at this like luxury resort in Byron Bay in Australia. And it's Splendor, that was Splendor in the Grass.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
it's another big festival.
We were in our hotel room for like 2 hours, you know, so.
Yeah.
So that's the only crappy thing. Cause like, so that's why when we went to Brazil and Julie didn't go because she was pregnant and it was, what was the virus that you
Zika
were trying
virus.
To, the Zika virus. So she didn't want to get exposed to Zika virus when she was pregnant. So I went down there with our friend Liv Marcico and she filled in, but I was like, I'm extending this trip because I don't know when I'm ever going to be in Brazil again. It's so hard to get a visa down there. And you know, it's so expensive to get down there and everything. I'm like, I am extending this trip. So her and I flew out after Sao Paulo. We flew out to Rio and had a vacation. We stayed where Anthony Bourdain stayed when he made his episode down there in the exact same Airbnb. And
amazing.
Which was an accident. I actually didn't know that at the time. I just Googled the neighborhood he was in. And then when found the place that I liked, and then I found out that was the same spot later, but had this amazing trip down there. But anyways, I digress.
I wanted to talk about England for a minute because I've always respected the English fans and critics more than the US. I have to say it. I don't care who agrees with me or not. They seem to know it and they get it and they got you guys. I mean, that seemed to pave the way for you guys. Did you have any ill feelings about the fact that you the US was there, but it wasn't quite there the way England was for you?
Well, like I talk about the perfect storm of elements to launch something and make it successful. And I just think, this is sort of like a music business insider take on this, but the effort wasn't like well coordinated between North America and the UK. So like, I think the label over here had different ideas. They had this individualistic attitude about how they were going to do it. And I think they really needed to just follow the UK label's lead because again, like the UK label had kind of more of an idea of how to launch it properly. I also, in turn, from a business growth standpoint, you really want to scale in a smaller place, right? If you're scaling up. So like budgetarily and logistically, scaling a band in the UK makes sense because you can be there for 2 weeks and you can hit every major market. You know what I mean? You can get so much done. You can like build a groundswell. And then from there, then you go over somewhere bigger, but you wait until you're kind of in a state, have a stable foundation before you start like bleeding out a lung trying to make North America work. You know, touring over here is so hard. Everything is so far away. It's so vastly different. Yeah, and like there were just stupid things, like the release dates were different.
Yeah, I feel like that's really, I don't know what the right expression is, but clipped our wings in a lot of ways. It was very weird. Yeah.
You guys really did a lot of touring, a lot of work between the first record and the second record. I mean, I remember, I think you toured with Wolf Mother, which is a great match for you guys, by the way. Peaches. Yeah. I mean, you guys did a lot of touring. And then you had the second record, Femagism. Did I say it right? Because I always worry that I never say it right. Royal Jelly, by the way, is one of my favorite songs. Period. I love that song. Smile More also. Oh, I've been trying to get that. There's a 7-inch single of Smile More, right?
Oh.
I think there is.
I think it was on, was it on one of those limited release things, Julie?
I don't know. I don't know if there, I don't think I have it. If it
remember that we were on some of those sort of like library release things. It may have been that.
Yeah. You won it? Cool.
No, wow. I want it.
Oh, you want it.
I wish I want it. Did
Where
you?
Is it? What is it?
You know, just one quick question about Femagism. Did you like, how was it working with the guy from the Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs? Nick Zinner?
It was a dream. Yeah. A dream come true, you know.
Were you a fan of theirs?
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge. Yeah. Very influential on us. Yeah, it was honestly, that was part of the reason that we walked away from our first record label was because we knew that he was the guy and we felt we were on the right path when we started working with him. But, you know, they were really trying to A&R us and wanted us to try working with all these different, you know, big shot songwriter producers and do the whole major label thing, you know, and we felt like this is it. Like we get to make this record with like one of our musical heroes. Like this is it. It's simple. So,
yeah.
The first record's, you know, almost, it's okay. I'll say it. It's a masterpiece. But the second record, I really like
wow,
a lot.
Thanks.
I know. I didn't have to really push that out that hard.
Thank you. Wow.
I'm gonna move along here because there's still so much. I mean, you toured with Garbage, Blondie. Okay, just one quick question about the collaboration with Flaming Lips. I just have to say that when I heard that cover of The Pusher, because I was a huge fan of that song, but your version of it is nothing like the original version. And the video got me high just from watching it, you know? I mean, what was that experience like for you working with the Flaming Lips?
The best thing ever.
Really?
Yeah, it was so fun.
Yeah.
It was so fun. It was, yeah, it was Wayne Disneyland, you know, it's Wayneland.
Wayneland.
Lipsland. Yeah, it's pretty special. I actually just re-listened. I don't usually listen to my own music, our music, but I re-listened to that the other day because my daughter got a, my four-year-old, she got a pink CD player for Christmas and some, and she got some Disney Princess CDs, but John, my fiance, he pulled that Deep Lip CD out for some reason. He's like, Georgia, listen to this. This is mommy. And usually she only wants to listen to her music, like kids' music, but she was actually like into it. And I was like, wow, she actually likes it. That's cool. And that what I realized listening to that record, well, how incredible it is. How incredible, underrated it is.
Yeah, oh my God. Absolutely.
Also, how many F-bombs are on it? I was like, ooh.
did you actually, you probably knew the song, The Pusher, right? Did you know the song or did someone say, let's cover this song?
Well, I didn't really know that song, to be honest. I think I'd heard it, but I wasn't like, I didn't know much about it. I have to be right. BRB. Julie, can you?
BRB.
Yeah. Julie, you know, the original version of that's like 8 minutes long and you guys made a 3 minute song out of it. That was pretty incredible. Yeah. Did Wayne basically kind of coordinate everything musically or was it more of a group effort in terms of how you recorded it?
Wayne really did. We went over there for like a week. We stayed at his house.
Oklahoma City?
Yeah. And he has a studio there. I mean, that's where they do everything. And so we were in with him and Stephen Drozd. And we were kind of hashing out. We wrote three songs at that time together. And then our time was up and, you know, we had been doing a lot of collaborations at the time. And when we reached out to Wayne, it was in that idea. So we had made songs with, you know, KT Tunstall, Peaches, mm-hmm. with Soko, with Jenny Lee from Warpaint, with Jenny V from Eagles of Death Metal, with Aisha Hassan from Savages, with Jamie Hintz from The Kills. So we had already been doing all these collabs. And so we reached out to Wayne as part of that. So he's like, yeah, just come, we'll do some stuff. And then basically he'd been working on those songs, like mixing those songs that we'd worked on with him and Steven. And he was like, you know, I think we should make a whole record. We were like, okay, yeah, that sounds good.
How long were you down there for?
We were down there for a week. So the way we completed the record was we did it remotely. And it was for the pandemic, but it was just to get it done. So he would like work up a lot of the music, send it to us. We would track vocals, but he had a very specific vision and we were like happy to, you know, follow his lead. So then we had the whole record, but a lot of those songs were songs that were rejects from the Miley Cyrus record he did.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't hear that. That's crazy. Yeah,
now you know. So like, and he was just, I'm sure he came up with Deep Lips. Wayne is the man with the plan. You know what I mean? Like he is a visionary without a doubt.
Certainly is.
Across every aspect of what you're doing. You know what I mean? Yeah, he was incredibly inspiring. I mean, deep, crazy respect. Like for me, the Soft Bulletin is like in my top 10. You know, I spent easily 10,000 hours listening to the Soft Bulletin. It's a deeply meaningful, formative record for me as an artist, like without a doubt. So yeah, that was truly.
I didn't know how you guys were. I didn't know what your reaction would be when I brought that up because I don't. You can never tell whether the artist really liked the record they made or not, you know, until afterwards. But it sounds like it was genuinely a good thing for you guys.
So good. It's so good. Yeah, I was listening to it. I was like, wow. It's...
I wanted to talk about Marriage for a few seconds because I thought that was a really good record too. The Arts Desk. Com wrote something really good. They wrote, "The swagger is back, the volume is full whack, and they've broken free of the obvious creative constraints of only employing two instruments by bringing on board some of the cream of the musical sisterhood." I love that quote.
Aww.
Never heard that. That's really
nice. I didn't either.
It's an English publication, the artsdesk.com.
Well, I didn't read, I didn't read reviews for this for Marriage because I was too traumatized. I learned early on not to read reviews. Even though like most of them are good, it's, you know, it's negativity bias, you know, that people have. So it's always like the bad stuff that sticks with you. So I stopped doing that, but that's really cool. That's awesome.
This is what happens when you make an absolutely brilliant first record. You always have to keep living up to what you've done in the past and stuff, you know?
No, but even the reviews, there were reviews of the first record that were, you know, problematic.
Really? I didn't read those.
Yeah, I mean, we were well reviewed, but then it's like, for me, music reviews should be done by people who appreciate and understand whatever it is you're doing. That's at least the starting point. So like we would have, there were a few reviews of Cistrionix of people who didn't like that genre. Why are they even reviewing it then? Like, what can they possibly inform potential fans of that music? That always like sticks in my craw when that kind of a thing happens. Not just for me, for any artist. It's like you reading your review, I can tell that you don't even understand why this music is happening, which you can understand why it's happening, and you can, well, reviews are so dumb anyway, by the way, like
you gotta do your research though
and decide for themselves.
I'm like, on your side here, you know, even though I've been on both sides of the coin, you got to do your research and you got to know what you're writing or you're talking about. Like I'm talking to you, suppose I didn't know about any of this stuff, I'd come across as an idiot, you know. I mean, you shouldn't try and do something that you don't understand. I mean, if you don't like a record, why review it?
Yeah.
So I also feel like Deep Valley, we were both like, I don't know, we were both, what's the word? Like either we should have come out in the 70s or we should have come out like
in the 90s.
Or 90s or like 5 or 10 years later. Like I feel like we came out in a weird time. I don't know.
You did. You did. I mean, that was a real dead time in the music business. You know, CDs were like dead, you know, and sales were hard to come by. Now we have this vinyl, you know, revival, you know, but I first heard in September that you guys had made the decision to move on. And I had a feeling, and I think I'm right, that a lot of it had to do with motherhood and things like that. And I did read in an interview that you did that you guys wanted to spend more time with your children. Is that pretty much the main reason?
It's a big part of it, you know? I mean, and also like Julie wanted to go back to school and I didn't really have the interest in keeping the band kind of, I don't know, keeping the band going without her. I don't know. It's kind of,
it's just weird, like
weird thing. So
it's just, honestly, I think at the end of the day, it's a financial reality, you know? It's like, we didn't even like make the decision to break up. We just, it wasn't working and it wasn't going to work. So at least we're like, well, let's give it a good last hurrah instead of just, it's like, oh, there's no Deep Valley anymore, like whatever. But the reality of being moms and having two kids and touring, like you need to be at a certain level to be able to make that work, you know, because at a certain point, all of your childcare expenses are just cannibalizing any money you make, any little pittance of money you squeeze out, you know, unless you're at a certain level. I mean, it's like, there's kind of, it's like any other economy. There's sort of no middle class here, you know?
And I think one of you said in an interview that it's easier for guys to do, and it's true. It's true.
Yeah. Guys don't have to bring their kids with them.
Right.
You show me any guy who took his baby on tour on a whole album cycle. Just show me one.
Yeah.
I want anyone to show me one. Can anybody show me one?
The Killers.
I'm totally open to Flowers. It's possible.
No, not Brandon Flowers. Yeah, Brandon Flowers from The Killers, right?
Yeah, I'm just joking. Did his wife go? like my no, husband.
I'm half joking, but I'm pretty sure like they had their own tour bus for his family and all of his kids and his wife. So it's a totally different scenario.
Because his wife is there for the childcare and probably a babysitter. But I think like, so my husband and I, so we have some touring coming up and my husband is touring at the same time. And when he told me that, I'm like, oh, so you're going to take the kids with you, right? He's like, I don't, how are we going to do this if we're both gone? Like, you're going to take them with you, right? And so it's like, it's preposterous because of course he was like, no. And that never even occurred to me. But meanwhile, if I'm touring, I have to either decide whether I'm taking them with me or, you know what I mean? It's just, it's so different. I don't know yeah. if there's a way to equalize it. There's such a deep feeling that at the end of the day, when push comes to shove, mommy is responsible, period.
I get it.
Myself,
well, and it's like these years are so fleeting too, you know, like these young years, and it's like, I don't know. It's you need to be there for your kids and you want to make the most of it. So I don't know. I mean, even it's not like super convenient for me that we're doing this tour when we are, cause like I still have an infant and I'm going to like leave him behind for a couple weeks, which is like sad, you know, but I just didn't think it was in my kids' best interest to take them along on this next thing. So they're going to be at home. I'm lucky. I have a granny nanny. Like my mom is so helpful. I'm so lucky. She's going to come down. And, I mean, I don't have her all the time. She lives in Northern California and I live in Southern California, but when I really need her, she'll come down and help. So I'm really fortunate that
that's great.
You know, cause my fiance, you know, is working super busy. Like we need childcare in a way. So
just a couple things and then I'll let you guys go. You're re-recording the first record. Did you already re-record the whole record?
We did. The release date is February 1st. Sister Onyx 2.0 is coming out. Yeah.
Is that it's coming so on a good. Vinyl?
Yep.
Ooh.
Yeah, you can pre-order vinyl. It's a double vinyl because there's 10 bonus tracks. So like unreleased demos, and then Deep Valley's version of like B-sides and rare tracks.
I can't believe how good it is. Like, I'm just gonna say, like, it was Julie's idea originally, and I was super annoyed, and I was like, I didn't want to do it.
I heard Baby I Can Hell.
The record's out of print. And we would, you know, and a lot of people asked for it. And we also like don't really make money from that because it was a major label deal. We don't really make money from those songs, even though they're like a lot of our most streamed songs. So it was either like license the record from Island or re-record it. I was super annoyed by it at first. I didn't want to do it because I was just like, we had a big budget. We had a lot of time to do that first record. Like, it was so long ago. I'm like, I don't even know if my voice is that good anymore. Like, I don't know if we're going to have the same magic and energy. Like I couldn't remember like all the thing, you know, the overdubs and things I did on my guitar. Like, but we did it raw and dirty. We did it quicker. And we kind of had a different approach this time. Which was like, the philosophy was not to like necessarily recreate the first record, but to kind of do the songs as they are now. So like how they have evolved over the years with all the times we've played them live, you know, they morph a little bit over the years, and we do a lot of our songs in different keys now. And, you know, so that was part of the approach, was just not recreating it, but just kind of doing a sort of slightly different, just the version of it as it is now, I guess. And we also added, I played bass on all the songs.
I saw that.
Super fun and sounds so heavy and cool. And I was like, oh, okay. This is why you need a bass player. Because listening to the songs now, like with the bass, with me playing bass on them, like it adds such just a deep, dark bottom end that's like so Sabbath sometimes and just so dynamic and heavy and cool, you know?
I heard Baby I Can Hell because it's up on online. I think it was on YouTube or someplace. I heard it. It sounded fabulous, man. I was like, wow. So the last show that you're doing, I know you're going to be up here in the Boston area in February, and I know you have about 10 other dates, but I think I saw that Mexico City is the last show.
Yes. When is this airing?
Next Monday.
Okay.
What, you giving me a scoop on something?
No, I'm not going to give you a scoop.
I think there's going to be a show.
We'll just leave it at that. But yeah, for now, Mexico City.
I'm going to bet that there's going to be an LA show that you're not telling me about.
Well, there's the LA show's on March 9th at the Terragram Ballroom.
But I met another one at the end, you know, after Mexico City.
A big announcement is coming, but
none of it's like confirmed yet or finalized. So even we don't really know.
That's okay. I'm not going to pry. I believe you.
But but yeah, our last show might be in the country
where you blew up.
Where we blew up. Yeah. But anyway, Wembley Stadium.
Wembley. You heard it, folks. Wembley Stadium. Zeppelin's getting back together to open for you guys, I heard.
That's right.
Next door to Wembley Stadium, there's a little mini mart. We're going to play in there. But yeah, Mexico City.
Hey, thank you.
Greatest place on earth.
Thank you guys so much for doing this.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us. You were very refreshing to speak to.
I love your accent.
And I'm hoping that I make it to the Crystal Ballroom in Somerville. You like my accent, really? It started as a Boston accent, but it ended up, I was in LA for 15 years. So that must be what happened. I don't know.
Yeah. And
go ahead.
Oh, never. It's okay. I have a couple questions, but we can, after we.
Yeah, I can stop it, but thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much,
yeah,
man.
Thank you so much. Yeah, this was really, really, really great. Really, you're super kind and cool and awesome and really appreciate
it. Research.
Yeah, all the nice things you said about our band. I never go in with high expectations for these things. I'm not going to lie.
Wow.
Oh,
thank
but you're pretty awesome.
Yeah. Deep Valley, Royal Jelly, from the 2016 album Femagism. I think I said it right. Femagism. I have to say, I love talking with Lindsay and Julie. They were fantastic. Honestly, I don't know what to expect when I do these interviews. I get really excited. I get really nervous. But man, did they deliver the goods. They talked for a long time, as you noticed. I can't wait to see them at the Crystal Ballroom in Somerville on Sunday, February 18th. Sunday, February 18th, Crystal Ballroom, Somerville. There are tickets still left. So if you want to go hang out with Deep Valley and me, please come. It will be sad that they're leaving, but it will be some serious rock and roll that night. And it's been serious for them. They're a great band and loved having them on the show. Could you tell? You can reach me anytime at twistedrico@gmail.com. We have an Instagram page, Facebook, Threads, and a YouTube page where you can actually watch the Zoom interview I did with Lindsay and Julie. There's also a TikTok page at Twisted Rico where we put up a bunch of clips. There'll probably be clips from this show. If you want to support this show, and I please hope you do for only as little as $1 a month, check out our Patreon site over at patreon.com/twistedrico. It was a hot one today. Till the next time we say goodbye, this is Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. Keep the rock and roll alive.